Welcome, everybody, to The Rad Life, the only talk radio show that takes you along with host and age explorer Rod Gontos on his continuing journey of discovery into life's challenges, opportunities, options, and all the latest and greatest things that come with getting older. The Rad Life is brought to you this week by Your Home for a Lifetime, a company dedicated to empowering you to stay safely, independently, and comfortably in your own home. And now here is your host, Rad Gontos.
So usually I sit on the other side of this table. So I'm sitting in what is normally the guest seat, the primary guest seat, and we usually have about three or four people. And Paul is quote-unquote behind the scenes. The camera is usually pointing this way, so you see a Rad Life thing. So if you're watching it on, depending on what camera you're watching it in, you might be watching me point to certain things. We have a screen here, has the logo on whatever show is on the air at the time, and then there's the behind the scene. This is where the sausage gets made, right there. The whole mess. Did you just do that?
I started to go, and I thought, wait a minute, I'll think twice about it.
Okay, this is the stuff I have to see while you guys don't see when we're normally on the air, right? It's Paul being Paul, right? So, as I usually do in the show, I ask the guests to introduce themselves. So this time, Paul Roberts, would you introduce yourself, please?
Happily. I'm the founder, owner, and crazy wizard behind OC Talk Radio, Orange County's only community radio station, and a very unique new media model. I think we're the only one of our kind in the country here.
Emphasis on the word crazy, by the way. And he's pretty amazing, right? And this guy here that we joke about, you know, wearing cargo pants.
Jeans on today.
Actually, he's wearing jeans, and he's wearing like dark denim jeans. I'm impressed. You know,
I must have known.
Have you been talking to our sponsor, Dave Welsh from Bespoke? Dave, are you styling Paul now? That's very impressive.
Trying to make me look.
Okay, so he is maybe listening to some of the stuff that happens on this show. Paul, how long have you been in radio?
I'm old as dirt, so I was in real radio
Come on. You're going to rob people? You usually do this at least once every show. How old are you, Paul Roberts?
I'm 61.
Okay.
I'm 61. And so I started off in college. I ran the college radio station at the University of Michigan and then went on to work in real radio, WIQB, which we used to kiddingly say stood for Why I Quit Broadcasting. I was out of a trailer in Ann Arbor. And then worked at WMYK, K94, in Norfolk, Virginia. I had to learn to say Norfolk and not left.
Norfolk.
There's no R in there. Just real fast.
Norfolk today.
Norfolk, Virginia.
How's Norfolk today? Okay.
That's a whole other story.
Oh, anyway. Man. Okay. But it's really interesting, right? Because you didn't just pursue, like, radio from college all the way through. You had, like, a couple of changing careers, right?
Oh, yeah.
Which we talk about are sort of indicative of boomers is sometimes there's been career changes. I remember being business school and having the honor and privilege and fortune to be in classes that were taught by Peter F. Drucker.
Amazing.
The godfather of management.
Amazing.
One of the things that stuck with me from Peter Drucker, and for those who are alumni, Claremont Graduate School, is...
It's just alumni. There's no S.
Alumni.
Yeah, there's no
okay.
S.
Thank you. I'm so glad you're here to correct me. So one of the things that Peter Drucker used to say is that on average, people will change career path about five times in the course of a lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
And if you really think about it, especially for my fellow entrepreneurs and sort of business, private business owners or sole proprietors, you know that this is true. Sometimes out of necessity, sometimes out of pursuit of passion, sometimes just because that's how the career path takes you. You have a falling out with corporate, you go off, and sometimes it undulates. You go from corporate to self-employment, back to corporate, because now you've developed a skill set. So Mr. Paul Roberts here...
You went to college,
but did you go to college for communication?
No. I studied political science and history. I was an honors major. I wrote my senior honors thesis on the Nixon-Kissinger foreign policy and its impact on the Cold War, something I was just discussing with the busboy at our restaurant the other day.
So there you go, ladies and gentlemen. A college education is never wasted. Okay, you just never know when you're going to need it talking about something like this with a busboy in Orange County. I'm actually impressed on a number of levels. it explains a lot about the political bent sometimes that we happen to have on these shows. Secondly, I'm really impressed that busboys in Orange County actually get engaged in a discussion that is to the level of an honor student.
Very educated.
Don't you find that kind of like – I feel like there's hope for the future.
So I thought I was going to go into either law or foreign affairs. I did go to law school after that. I went to William & Mary in Williamsburg, Virginia. Quickly found out I hated law with a passion, and that's where I started working in radio. On the side, I ran the college radio station there. I'm supposed to be in law school, and I'm running the college radio station there, and then working professionally in Norfolk, and then dropped out of college and decided, because I actually got sick. I got mono, the dreaded kissing disease. I remember the girl I kissed
too. Oh, you remember?
Oh yeah.
Okay.
I know who you are.
And we look her up on Facebook, do we?
And I don't remember her name, but I remember her face.
Okay.
Anyway, so I dropped out and decided that after I got better 6 months later, I wasn't going back to law school, wasn't going back to radio. I came to California to be a rock star, writer, superstar, any of those. I would take any of them. And instead, I ended up selling copiers. I used it as a battering ram to get in the door to all these studios. I sold a copier to Francis Ford Coppola, but he didn't buy me. He bought the copier. And everywhere I went, I'd say, what do you do here? That's what I want to do. And one day, I sold a PR firm in Beverly Hills. I said, I want a job. They said, do you even know what PR is? I thought, Paul Roberts, PR. I was born to do this. And off of that joke, they hired me, and that's I started a whole new career.
You got a career path change because you used your name and initials as a joke for standing for PR.
Honest to truth.
Honest to God story.
And I did that for 20 or 30 years and thought that was kind of my career with some little plays in and out. I ran some restaurants and bars and did some other things. I built some restaurants and Irish pubs. Worked on some political campaigns. Did a whole bunch of stuff under that kind of realm of PR. And along comes the Great Recession, wipes out my PR business, and
What year was this?
The Great Recession, 2008, 2009, whatever that was.
You realize there were some people that weren't born then, right? So for the benefit of those, yeah.
I was my business had, for some reason, moved into lifestyle products. I was big in the hot tub industry. I handled Sundance Jacuzzi and other brands. I was big in the billiard industry. I handled Brunswick and other big names. I handled outdoor barbecues, all this stuff I thought was going to ride me into the sunset. And instead, it all disappeared. Hot tubs, within a year, dropped 70%.
I mean, it's California.
Yeah.
Hot tubs and outdoor barbecues, I'm surprised you're not a millionaire.
Well, I should have been. I could have been. And I could have been a contender. So anyway, I had to reimagine myself in my 50s now, and I'm thinking, what am I going to do? So I literally sat home for a year and ate through my savings and closed up my other business. And at first,
So you went to college for political science.
Political science and history.
And then switched to law, but right. Then... said, forget that. Now, I'm guessing you switched to law because you figured you weren't going to make it financially in political science, or why did you switch to law?
That's the $64,000 question. My dad wanted me to be a lawyer.
Okay, so it was sort of more...
And everybody who had political science went to law school, and I thought, I did it reluctantly. I didn't, and that was a bad choice, because I got there and I hated it.
Would you say, because I have a reason for asking along the way here, is I don't think your journey is necessarily... I hate to put it to you this way, but not necessarily unique. Right?
Oh,
because
everything I do is unique.
I understand. You're a baby boomer. Of course it is, right? But and forgive me for even thinking that that's not the case, right?
Okay.
Right? I want it all I want it now. Why is it taking so long to get, right?
Yeah.
Pretty much, yeah. Sums up the generation. But there was probably a sense of whether actual pressure or perceived or taken upon by yourself pressure of certain set standard career paths that would be acceptable safety careers, like engineer, attorney, doctor.
Here's the crazy part. When I graduated...
I'm trying to point out a difference in generations.
I graduated in 1978 from the University of Michigan with a magna cum laude, high honors, magna cum laude, Phi Beta Kappa, all the stuff you could... Political science and history. I had a double
and
major.
History, wow,
right.
Okay.
And...
pretty heady stuff, Paul.
Pretty heady stuff. Michigan was, at that time, I still think it is, one of the top three or four political science programs, one of the top three history programs. I couldn't decide which one I liked more, so I did both, which was very unusual. Wrote an honors thesis about both. All this stuff that just sounded like it was, wow, I'm on some kind of fast track.
Yep.
Here's the amazing thing. I never once, not once... thought about what I was going to do after I left law school, or
college. So you were focused on getting the college thing done.
Enjoying it, running, loved what I was doing, loved what I was studying, and then loved working in college radio, these two totally opposite career paths. And nobody ever once asked me, what are you going to do when you graduate?
Right.
My dad would try it, and I say, Dad, don't.
Well, then you went and that puts you in college in the 70s.
Yeah.
So, you know, this is not 60s.
Yeah, right.
You know,
I was after that.
This is 70s.
After the student the University of Michigan, one of the reasons I went there, because it was the center of the universe for the student revolution. It's where Tom Hayden went to school. It's where the SDS was founded.
Mm-hmm. Those who don't know what SDS is?
Students for Democratic Society.
Okay.
And the whole student revolution was built around three colleges in the United States, maybe four. The University of Michigan, University of Wisconsin, Berkeley, and maybe Columbia. Those were the kind of the hotbeds for the whole student. The idea that students could change the world and that we weren't going to accept the world our parents gave us, that was very appealing to me.
But it's important that this was in the 70s.
Which
not
was a couple years after that whole thing had faded and fizzled out the war. We got out of the war in Vietnam. Nixon got in a little bit of trouble.
Yeah.
And all of this kind of put a downer in the whole thing. So I kind of felt like I just missed it. My friends' older brothers and sisters had gone through it, but I had sort of missed the excitement. And, in fact, if you want it, I'll tell you a funny story.
Please.
All right. Go look up the SDS. At one time, Tom Hayden, who was married to Jane Fonda, was one of the founders of the SDS. He was the editor of the Michigan Daily, their student newspaper there. He was one of the five people that disrupted the Democratic Convention in 1968.
Chicago.
The Chicago 7 or 5
Yeah.
Anyway, big center of this revolution. My parents were frightened that I was going to go to Michigan. They actually thought, oh, my God, he's just going to turn into some long-haired hippie and drop out. And they were really scared, even though it was all these schools were excellent academic schools, but... You know, this rich. I was kind of a rich kid. Us rich kids. I wasn't rich, but we were well off.
You were what they used to be known as a comfortable middle class.
Yeah, upper middle class.
Upper middle class. Upper middle class. Is there such a thing anymore?
No.
Yeah.
My dad was an executive with a car company. We lived out in the suburbs. Everybody I knew's father was an executive.
Two and a half kids.
So all of a sudden, I'm at there, and I'm just, we're going to save the world. And I thought this was very appealing. And so but I missed it. You know, I started in 1974, and the student revolution kind of petered out, like maybe 77. 71 was Kent State. Or 70 was Kent State. 71, 72, we pulled out of the Vietnam War in what, like 73, I think. So it was, I just missed it by a couple of years. And the fever had died down, the revolution had died down, the excitement had died down. But there were still a couple of people hanging around. And when I went to work at the college radio station, I found out that it was a hotbed for this whole revolutionary stuff here. And there was rumored to be an ex-founder of the SDS who still came down at night. Nobody knew.
Pirate radio?
Like pirate radio.
Pirate radio.
He wasn't in the studio any longer, but he had been the founder of, this is WCBN.
Had keys to the studio.
Right there, WCBN. Yeah. And he would come down. They'd let him do it like 3 o'clock in the morning. He'd come down. His name was John Sinclair. Now, if you grew up where I did in Michigan, he was a legendary, a regionally famous person. Why? He had three things. One, he had been the author of the famous Port Huron Statement, which, go Google it, at the time, was the SDS's...
Port Huron.
Port Huron, from up in...
Most people on the West Coast don't even know where Huron is.
Port Huron. Huron's one of the Great Lakes. Port Huron's up around the northern tip of Michigan. And the SDS and all these other revolutionary groups met, and they put out this manifest, their statement of how they thought they were going to change the world, this rambling nonsense of how they're going to change everything. And it was called the Port Huron Statement. He was the author of that. The second thing, even more famous, is he was the... He was arrested for smoking marijuana in 1970, 71, something like that, and convicted of a felony.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in Ann Arbor, we were so revolutionary that within the city limits, it was a misdemeanor to smoke marijuana. So it was a $5 fine if you got caught. But a minute it went outside the border, it was a felony, and he got caught and thrown in prison for like several years. And John Lennon, no less than John Lennon, came and did a concert with a bunch of other artists in Ann Arbor to raise money to save John Lennon, wrote a song about Save John Sinclair. And I was like, oh, my God, this guy wrote the Port Huron Statement. He was thrown in prison for smoking dope. And John Lennon came and did a concert to raise money to free him.
So
now, and one more.
Yeah, go ahead.
He also was the manager of the MC5. Kick out the jams.
So, okay. Anyway. Nobody really.
Early punk, yeah.
Most people don't put Ann Arbor and radical as a.
Oh, if you right? back there, you
you're,
do.
You're
yeah.
right, okay. So it's interesting. So you pretty much sound like had a really full experience in college.
Yes. Now, so I'm going to finish the story. So John Sinclair was still rumored to come down at night.
Yeah.
This famous fading fallen figure of the student revolution. I had to meet this guy. This is the guy that made my parents.
You're stalking the hallways of
yeah.
the radio
so
station
I asked,
at night?
As I started the radio station, I asked, is this true? Does John Sinclair come down? He said, no, we never know. Sometimes he drives down and we let him go on the air and, you know. And I said, I got to meet this guy. So one night, they said, okay, I think he's coming. And so I stayed up till like 3 o'clock in the morning, came down the station. It was like out of some movie. It's completely
this
dark.
This really is like guerrilla pirate radio.
Yeah, it was.
Right?
You could see, we had several studios, so you could see through the glasses all the way down through to the far studio where he was this little figure, and there was one little light bulb on, and you could sort of see him dimly sitting in there.
In the shadow. Of
in the
light.
Shadow. And he's playing some crazy music, you know. And so anyway, I go down there, and I have to meet him and shake his hand. And I walk, and here is this fat, frumpy, to me, looking middle-aged man. He's probably 35 or something. I'm 19. He's probably 25 or 30 or something. And I thought to myself, this fat, frumpy guy, hi, I'm John Sinclair. I thought, this is a guy that made my parents shake in their boots. This frunky, stoned guy sitting down in the booth down here is what made the world shake and everybody was so frightened of. And that sort of blew my whole I was disillusioned after that.
You were disillusioned?
I was. I thought.
So with that experience, I mean, that sounds like burst your bubble and, you know, you're the student. You're this you know, summa cum laude honor right. student with political science. And you're in a hotbed of what is still
student
sort of
revolution. Still simmering.
And you're in radio, and you got this, you know, bully pulpit with the microphone
right.
projecting, and then you get disenchanted and disillusioned because this person that you have elevated on a pedestal ends up being this frumpy middle-aged man.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right.
Well, I'm going to get back to that at some
okay.
point. Right? He knows where I'm going with that too, right? But
no.
so then,
a la me, he looks like me.
Ta-da! Sinclair
John
of
Sinclair.
San Clemente,
yeah.
or of Southern California. So okay, so you then go off,
yes.
and you got to make a living.
I hope none of my friends are listening to this.
You got to make a living. Oh, I'm sure they all are.
Okay.
You got to make a living, right?
Yes.
So then you go in different paths.
Try some different camera shots.
Right.
Here. Okay.
You got a different path.
Right.
Right. And then.
I graduated and I'm stunned. I didn't know what
you had
to
no
do.
Idea what you were going to do next.
And the rude awakening hit me that I was going to have to
was
go
that
and get
common,
a job.
You think, to a lot of people in your,
yes.
in your generation?
Yes. None of us were thinking.
The sort of future planning
was. What seems
wasn't
so
really
obvious that you took a career in the intent of going out and getting a job for it never occurred to us. We were there to grow our minds, to think freely, to experiment and try stuff. And then when it left, it was like, oh, my God.
And we've talked about this before, right? We've talked about how this is also part of the baby boomer sort of characteristics.
Yeah.
Is that for all your lives as a generation, you have basically blazed trails.
Reacted.
You've gone down paths.
Live in the moment.
Walked the path least traveled.
Yeah,
you know,
and live in the
lived
moment.
In the moment,
right.
in the now. And it's ironic that now at this point in your lives, you're scared to death. And you say it yourself.
Yes,
you're scared to death because you're like, oh my God, all of a sudden you're thinking about what's coming in the future. When all your rest of your life, you didn't even bother and didn't even get shaken at all.
Never talked about
by that
tomorrow.
Reality, right?
Never.
You never talked about tomorrow. You were
no.
in the now.
Right.
And we've said this, that perhaps reconnecting with that is really the salvation for baby boomers now. That their realities are truly big and that the stakes are high. But that to remind yourself and have the faith in the fact that all these different milestones in your lives as a generation, you have survived for a couple of key characteristics, and one of which is being in the now, finding the solutions for what it is now and not being paralyzed by the fear of what's coming.
But here's what undercuts that whole message. Yesterday, mm-hmm. I was informed that somebody I knew pretty well back in high school, mm-hmm. he was a year behind me, mm-hmm. Played in my band, or sat in with my band mm-hmm. a couple. I had a band in high school. He sat in with our band. He was a brilliant musician, went on to be, went to the University of Michigan like I did, ended up arranging the university marching band, which is one of the more famous ones in the country. Really, and then I kind of lost touch with him. I saw that he was still on Facebook, and that's it. He died. He's a year younger than I am.
Well, I have an answer for you. You're saying, how do I balance that out? How do I continue to be in
the now? So
you
say, don't worry
now?
About tomorrow, and people are dropping dead around me here.
How is worrying about it going to change that?
It won't. But
you kind of knew that, right?
Yeah.
Because there was instability. Yes, we were almost out of Vietnam, but you could still get drafted.
I was about a year or two away from being drafted.
You know, and this
I've been a year.
There were some shootings in certain universities. Sniper shot shootings.
Kent State.
In Kent State. You know, it was a volatile time.
Friends of mine died from drug overdose.
Right.
People were dying. It was the first years that you saw kids die from drug overdoses in the early
70s. And you would say, well, yes, true, but, you know, young basically are fearless. True, but I really think that your salvation as a generation lies in the strength you already have. It's just that you have started to buy into the Kool-Aid and drinking the Kool-Aid of when it's older,
fear.
I'm supposed to worry about the future.
Right.
Well, guess what? You didn't worry about the future all your lives. Why start a new habit now?
You're absolutely right. I can't deny that fear has crept into our lexicon. Fear has crept into our world.
None of us are getting out of here alive. Remember we say that, right? There's your mantra every morning. None of us are getting out of here alive. Fear is a mind killer, to throw in a little dune there.
I just can't believe, I look back, I feel foolish, that I graduated with what was arguably one of the best educations money could buy. In one of the most exciting places.
You never used it, though, did you?
You never used it. And
another reason why I'm telling you, you were armed with the tools to try to secure a safer path future, mm-hmm. and you still didn't take it.
No.
What did you do after college?
I went to law school by default. I didn't know what else to do. I was horrified, like, oh, my God, I mean, I got to go out and get a job.
Darn it. I got a job or I got to register and start school.
And stay in school. So, yeah. And my dad said he, you know, law school was his dream, not mine. Most people with political science degrees went into law school because they didn't know what else to do. And I thought, okay, by default, I'll go to law school.
Yeah, but I'm not buying that you did it for dad. I'm buying because you did it because you didn't know what else to do.
Yeah, both. So yeah. Please dad, which was always important, trying to please
dad.
By
the way, for those people who see me with this, no, it's not vodka for the 11th time. And no, they are. Voss is not a sponsor of the show yet.
Yet.
It's water. So
exactly.
Okay. P. Diddy has the same bottle, but it's usually vodka. So I'm no PDD, and that's not vodka. So, okay, so and then what brought you out to California, though? Was it the chasing being sort of the closest to a rock star or entertainment or whatever?
Clearly. So that...
So still a little...
So when I dropped out of law school...
Star luster?
Yeah, I dropped out of law school after a year. And,
starstruck.
Got well because I was sick, and mm-hmm. you know, with which was really depressing. You know,
it wasn't mono; it was being in law school that got you.
Well,
sick.
That it really was part of it. I was making myself sick anyway, truthfully.
Yeah,
and really, honestly, I was getting panic attacks and other things. I was getting really sick. It really was like finally my body saying enough, and finally everybody, my parents and me included, said enough. And so now I come back home, and it's time for school to start. And of course, I don't go back. And I'm sitting around, watch TV and, you know, just listening to music and going out partying at night. And my mom and dad said, you can't keep doing this. Got to go do somewhere. You either got to get a job or you got to go somewhere. And I thought, okay, again, I would have stayed in their basement forever, right? And
the 70s show, everybody.
Yeah, I would have lived the 70s.
It was the 70s show, yeah.
And so I thought, okay, I'm going to go to California because I had two choices. I wanted to be in the entertainment business, I thought. I'd always been my other passion. I'd been in plays and music and bands and other things.
And you start selling copiers.
I came to California.
And then somebody...
Well, before that, let me tell you the rude awakening. So I come to California, and I had some money saved up. And for about 6 months, I just partied and went to the beach. And, wow, this was just incredible because it was the middle of winter, and it's warm out.
Mom and Dad, I'm working.
Yeah, I'm really trying really hard.
Yeah.
And I moved in with an old hippie friend of mine, and we're just, you know, having wild times and doing wild things. And the money runs out after 6 months. Now, the reality hits me in the face, and I have to go get a job. So I thought, okay, I'll go get a job. So I put on my resume, go look in the paper. Sales jobs are the easiest things to get. My dad was a salesman. It was the last thing in the world I wanted to be was in sales. I thought, okay, I'm going to get a sales job for a while until something happens. And at the same time, I was auditioning. I was sort of half-assed trying to get in a band and do other things. And I
photocopier slash start so, in the making.
Okay. So before I do this, I go down and I thought, okay, I walk into some jobs and I show my resume. And I have this sterling academic resume, really, second to none. You don't see copies of it anywhere in the studio here because talk about feeling like worthless. I walked in, I said, okay, I'm Magna Cum
Laude. By the way, is that another characteristic of baby boomers? I don't know that I go, unless people are in the academic track, mm-hmm. I don't see a lot of homes with baby boomers where their certificates
no,
and everything,
I guess not.
Degrees are all on the wall.
Yeah, I don't know why.
Yeah.
So my dad was always so proud of me because he never went to college and never got any of this stuff. I had all this stuff he dreamed of and a great academic background, and I excelled at it and had all these accolades and awards and things and stuff. Fill them all out on my resume, and the first guy says, yeah, but if you sold anything, kid. They all talk like that. Yeah, kid, did you sell anything? And I went, well, no, but didn't you see my resume? Look at, you know, so give me my $100,000 a year job. All right, I'll do it. Let's go. And he's like, and nobody would hire me.
Uh-huh.
And I found out
no
this education
experience.
Was worthless. Mm-hmm. Worthless. Unless you wanted to go into academia, then it was worth a lot. Mm-hmm. But if I just wanted to go in the real world, it was worth less. Mm-hmm. Political science and history with all this stuff, mm-hmm. who cared?
Well,
what have you done lately?
I had an undergraduate in economics. It's sort of
kind of
similar.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
Yeah.
So I came out and got very bitter about that. I'm like, oh, my God, this is worthless. So I quickly – and I tried to get into the entertainment industry, and here's my first story. So I go down to Universal Studios, and I knock
on – What year is this, roughly?
1980. I came here in 1980. Okay. I go down and knock at the door, and
I think
it was locked.
Okay.
The HR department is locked.
At Universal?
Yeah. So I finally pounded and pounded until finally somebody pried it open. They said, yes. I said, I'm here to apply for a job. They said, what job? I said, I don't know. What do you got? So it doesn't work that way. And they closed the door. So I came back and a couple days later and pounded again. They said, yes, what is it? She said, well, you got to tell us what you're applying for, and we'll tell you if there's an opening. And I had to go take classes at UCLA at night to find out what all these jobs were called, editor, production assistant, anything I could think of. So I took, for about 6 months, I took classes, and then I came back, started knocking on the door. I'm here to apply for production assistant. No, none of those. Come back next week. I'm here to apply for a editor. No, you're getting warm, though. And I was just, I thought, this is nuts. You had to know somebody to get behind the door. So I quickly decided I needed a job where I could get behind the door. And so I took a job selling copiers because I used the copier as a battering ram. So when I showed up and knocked on the door,
and
copier,
anybody who knows what the size of copiers were in 1980.
Oh, you had to push them on a car. They were huge.
They were a battering ram.
So I would knock on
the
wheels,
so you didn't need to have a horde with you.
Exactly.
Yeah, you could do it yourself.
Every day you took your copier, you went up, and you're supposed to go up in cold call and go up and through the buildings and show it to people. I went over to Hollywood. I had the Hollywood territory, so I would use that, and I would get behind the door. And once I'd say, copier, and they'd say, oh, right, come right in. And then I would wander through the building. It was like being in the secret room, you know, like one of these
secret
installations,
the door.
You know. And because there was nothing on the outside, when you walked in, there was a beehive of activity on the inside. And I got into all sorts of places. That's where I did get into Zoetrope Studios. Francis Ford Coppola did have to come out and approve the copier sale himself. And then,
well, what were copiers going for in 1980, Paul?
Oh, they were $5,000-$10,000. They were big, yeah. And so he came out. And then, as I always did, while I was showing the copier, I said, you know, by the way, I'm really a writer, whatever I was that day, writer, director, producer, rock star, whatever I thought I was. And I did that over and over and over again until I told the story. I walked in and sold them to a PR firm. I had no idea what they did. I pitched them. I said, I was born to do this. They laughed, gave me a job, and they put me in the room with the copier. Because they didn't have an office. So they said, they gave me a phone, put a phone in with a little closet where the copier was, and I sat in this little closet-like office, and I had to go ask the lady.
There is Paul making copies. The Paul Meister. The skit from CNS.
Oh, you're talking about Pauly Shore, right?
The Paul Meister making copies on the copier.
Exactly. That was me. So all of a sudden, I had to figure out what we did. And nobody asked me if I was happy. They paid me $500 a month, and I said, I can't live on that. And they said, well, there's 1,000 other people who would take this job. I said, okay, I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll pretend I'm still selling copiers in the morning. So I didn't quit the copier job. I'd run around, and then I'd come in at like noon.
Part-time.
And I would stay till like 8 o'clock at night and be there. And I told my boss every single afternoon I was out. He thought I was the most aggressive salesman in the world. He thought I was always out making sales calls.
So a person who has no sales experience.
Right.
Who is coming from liberal arts education that is basically, they're realizing to their chagrin, is useless.
Yes.
Right?
you got it.
Is tenacious
right.
in pursuing a career path that had nothing to do with anything.
I'd ever even tried.
You probably didn't even realize that the dots were kind of connected.
Didn't even know this thing existed.
Okay,
but I wanted in the door at that point.
Go ahead.
And so I used to I'd run around and sell copiers in the morning, and in the afternoon I was telling Joan Collins advising her about her career. Joan Collins was one of our clients from
Hilarious.
And in the morning I'm selling copiers. It was just bizarre. And I did that for about a year and then moved up to a full-time job and then moved up to a bigger company a year after that. And within a couple of years, by the time I was 30, I was a partner in a firm. We handled Johnny Mathis, Anthony Quinn, Jose Feliciano, a bunch of others, my partner and I.
So how...
I'm 30.
You're 30 at this point. What kept you in that? What did appeal to you? Looking back now, from for the benefit of 31 years actually. Okay, what was it that kept you pursuing that track? Out of all the things
that's interesting. I've never thought about it. To me,
imagine that it was just happenstance.
It felt like it at the time. I had two paths up in my life always. I was always fascinated with politics and political issues, and particularly foreign affairs. Always just that was the historian in me and all that stuff. Just loved that.
And was that something that you grew up with at home?
It was something like I found when I was 3 out of nowhere. I loved
reading history. But were your parents engaged like that?
No.
Or no? Okay, so all right. Okay.
This came out of blue.
Interesting.
My parents always thought I was an alien. They never knew where I came from. None of this came from them. My dad was...
Any uncles or relatives that...
No, okay. Nothing. Somewhere along the way, I discovered history very early. And they started giving me all these, especially war. I was fascinated with war. I was Civil War, the American Civil War.
I mean, did you have any sort of important?
My dad was a bomber pilot in World War II. So there was a little bit of that. Yeah.
There was a legacy of your dad serving.
Yeah.
Right. Were there people in high school, teachers that were kind of mentors, anything like that?
Local
barber. I mean, I'm just trying to...
Nothing. I cannot point to anything. I became totally engrossed in the stories of American history, reading about, especially the biographies, Daniel Boone, Wyatt Earp, Wild Bill Hickok.
So was there part of you that maybe unconsciously or consciously recognized that you were in the midst of the happening and maybe being part of that in
I think
your
I was
role?
Being famous. I love this idea of being famous.
Or infamous.
History, I loved all these famous people in history and reading their biographies and stories and what they went through, especially in war, that just seemed so unbelievable.
Because to put that much energy and effort, anybody who's listening, by the way, I just want to give a shout out to a few people. Scott Duncan, who basically joined me and is a buddy of mine, says that, you know, it's after noon, after 12 o'clock, so vodka is okay. So cheers, cheers, Scott, to that. And Kat, thank you so much. I'm glad you're enjoying the show. It's something different for us, and I'm actually enjoying it very much.
Thanks for opening it up.
Right? It's really actually cool. I think everybody's learning about you, which is really cool. Anybody who's been in this room, you know, you pipe in, and we're like, oh God, couldn't he just shut up, right?
Really?
Well, the mic's on him. But this thing that you're talking about, I mean, this is pretty involved. A pursuit of passion, whether consciously
history,
or unconsciously.
I love the idea of being
famous.
You're
putting a lot of energy and effort in at this point.
And then the other thing, I hate to admit, I love the idea of being famous and all this stuff. And then I discovered theater and music when I was about in high school. And so that became this other. I ran with the kids that were in theater and music, and then I ran with these academic kids in history. And
so almost cliche say left brain, right brain.
Right.
Sounds to me like you really explored. And maybe accidentally or not accidentally, the environment and your parents and your economic level, you know, your being an upper middle class afforded you the ability to explore, and you either consciously or unconsciously took it.
Right.
Right? And tried all these different
always
things
through
college.
Always had these completely different groups of friends and completely different career paths. I was a straight-A student through college and on this academic high-powered career, and then I was also this hippie singing in bands, musician, all this stuff.
He was a 70s hippie wannabe.
I was a wannabe. I was more of a wannabe than anything.
Okay, and so you're now 30. You're a partner in a PR, Paul Roberts firm.
That's right.
In a PR firm.
Entertainment firm, Reflections.
What's the name of the company?
Reflections.
Reflections. Uh-huh. Interesting choice of names. really interesting choice of names. We are having a moment of reflection today.
Exactly.
Right? Okay, and then what happens? The economy goes under, what?
No, I had another epiphany, another one of those moments.
Which, if you watch closely, can happen at any time.
Yeah. There was one. Just throw. Just hit me.
See, he's dropping stuff, too.
Drop stuff.
Okay.
I looked ahead at my partner, who was 10 years older than I am, who was drank a lot, went out for 3 martini lunches, looked burned out. And
see,
I thought,
Scotty, we're back to alcohol again.
And I thought, here's where I'm headed. Partying with celebrities till 2 o'clock in the morning has a certain limited life appeal here. I also met the love of my life, my wife. We weren't married at that time. And started living together. And I thought, maybe there's another way to do this without all the entertainment stuff. Hmm. And so started doing more corporate, just by accident, picked up a couple of corporate clients. And that turned into a wild ride. And bit by bit got out of the entertainment.
What did you do
stuff.
For corporate clients?
PR.
PR, okay.
Yeah. And the first
so
one
it wasn't celebrity-based, now it's corporate-based.
Well, here's what was interesting. This is now early 80s. The word entrepreneur entered the language.
Mm-hmm. I remember Entrepreneur Magazine actually came out with
that. Entrepreneur Magazine came out with that. And suddenly, these startups were rock stars. We treated them as celebrities. The Bill Gates of the world.
We talk about people being their own, that you are your brand.
Right.
That concept didn't exist before the early 80s.
Yeah. Exactly. So all of a sudden it was cool and they were hip. The Steve Jobs, the people like that were suddenly cool to be, and there were a variety of other celebrity one of them. And I met one, not nearly as big
I'll
as
I'll get
that.
Him to do that, Scotty.
Felice and Boyd Willett, I'll give him a shout out. They were a bunch of real hippies, who had started this day runner company of these personal organizers. Mm-hmm. And originally it was a way to chart your life and track your thoughts and control your future and your destiny and all this stuff. It was about journaling and everything else. And Boyd had come out of the entertainment business. He was his father was a silent movie star or silent movie director. Mm. And he himself had been the art director in several big films, Ordinary People and mm-hmm. some other movies like
big
that.
Big films, yeah.
And so he had an artistic background, and he combined it with his wife's love of this. She was much more right brain, and he was much more whichever one's the organized one. And he was the organized – he was the crazy one. She was the organized one. And they created this thing called Day Runner, and it exploded. And for those that remember, everybody ran around with these little personal organ – Day Timers,
Day Runner. Let's have a show of hands for everybody who's watching. How many people remember Day Runner?
Or Day Timer, and there were 2 or 3 companies like it.
Yeah, okay.
And Day Runner was the biggest, and they had these wild color things like purses, and you carried everything into your credit cards and your contacts and your calendar and everything in it. And they exploded. And that was my first taste of entrepreneurialism. They took that company. When I met them, they...
Well, that's what made a lot of entrepreneurs possible.
Yes.
Is having the ability to organize their lives like this, especially if a lot of people are either entrepreneurs themselves or no entrepreneurs. There's a certain amount of chaotic, like organized chaos mm-hmm. that happens as part of that birthing and innovation mm-hmm. process that you need to have those guidelines in place, which you rebel against.
Right.
So that was a very timely product to be developed.
And it was a hot product, and it was on the cover of magazines.
Yeah.
And I picked them up as a client because they wanted the same celebrity treatment we were treating celebrities, mm-hmm. only they wanted it to be their celebrity.
It was almost what then became a PDA, a personal
personal digital assistant, right.
And then now has become the smartphone.
Right. So, which they missed, oddly enough. They missed that whole evolution into hardware, and their company blew up, and it was an amazing rise up and crash down.
You continue to have to innovate or you die.
Yeah, they did.
Yeah, right. they ended up dying. Yeah.
So,
now you'll find something that looks like it could be a day runner sold, you know, for peanuts at Marshall's or places like that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So that took me, when I picked up that client, I suddenly became hot for other entrepreneurs because they were very high profile and very successful. Within a year, They went their first year in business, they made grossed $1 million. The second year, they did $2 million, mm-hmm. then five, then 10, then 20, then 50, and then 100. It just was like a skyrocket. It was a, and they started this out of their house in on Harper Avenue, over right just next to the whiskey and all that stuff off of Sunset.
On Sunset, yeah.
And in what had been his father's old silent movie studio mm-hmm. a million years ago, when that was all farmland. And it was an amazing journey, and they were super hippies. They used to chant before meetings, and they had people come in and try and channel the energy and all sorts of wild, crazy stuff. And it was just
Hey, it's not wild, crazy. We do that in the spa industry every day.
Okay.
So,
well,
you know, it still lives on.
Just. So it was my fascination with the hippie culture, my fascination with celebrities, my fascination with new technologies mm-hmm. and owning your own business, and all this stuff came to head. And I thought it was more fun working with them and more profitable than trying to battle for celebrities.
So it's interesting because you had a fascination with fame.
Yeah, I don't know why.
And celebrity was your sort of first bite of that. Mm-hmm. Then you happened to be at the right time at the right place as entrepreneurs became superstars. Mm-hmm. And anybody who thinks about, like Bill Gates, Steve Jobs, roughly around you're the same
all
area, right?
In the 80s, yeah.
Around around the 80s. And
that's
all
when
the
first Apple came out.
Exactly.
That,
yeah. And so it became celebrities could be nerdy people that don't change clothes into anything else, other
cool
than what you wear all the time. But they were cool celebrities. And you were right there as that transition was happening.
And truthfully, the academic nerd in me, most people would probably think I was pretty nerdy when I was younger.
Yeah, I could see it then. I could see it now. Right.
So there was I really found the fact that nerdy people could be famous. Oh, yeah.
But you,
see,
again, I will remind you, okay, yeah. that your nature and your DNA wiring and your generational bent
right.
served you well because you did not get out and into this sort of corporate representation.
No.
Because of seeing an opportunity there. What you saw is the lack of desire to be that person that burnt out in the celebrity promotion.
Right.
Right? And you just, it took you, the road of your life took you where it needed to be at the right time.
And these people came to an entertainment PR firm.
Right.
They sought us out. Because they wanted to be treated as celebrities.
You know what? I'll tell you right now. I'm looking at redoing my website, and the one thing that I know is that what we do in terms of design and service to clients, what we offer is a luxury product,
mm-hmm.
and it is. So I am seeking out people. And I'll put the word out to anybody who's watching this now or later. We're looking for people that are comfortable and. I would say seasoned and sophisticated in how a luxury product is pitched.
Mm-hmm.
Because even though what we have is a service, and I know it's kind of a hard reach because it's not a really, it's not a diamond, it's not a car with a label
right.
or whatever.
Right.
But what we do is we basically, I'm insistent on basically repositioning our company in terms of the PR and the pitch around, and we are very much the brand of us, right?
Right.
And we're very personal that way, and we pride ourselves on being, but it is a luxury product. So we're seeking people outside the normal realm of maybe who pitches design or architectural firms and saying, luxury, sophistication and familiarity with the luxury industry and that client base, that's what we're looking to partner with.
Well, to close the loop, see if I can close this story, and tie some of these things together in a way I hadn't probably thought of till now. So my fascination with fame brought me to Hollywood. My experience in Hollywood accidentally coincided with the rise of entrepreneurs
right.
who were treated as famous,
right.
who were treated as celebrities.
Right.
And by morphing and taking the same skills I learned to make movie stars and rock stars famous and applying that to nerdy
entrepreneurs and yeah.
to teaching them as a personal brand, to teaching them as a celebrity, to teaching them as thought leaders, as experts, all of that stuff that now is common – particularly among service professionals.
Actually, it's probably become a little bit too contrived and controlled to
yes,
my liking.
I agree.
Because we try to take
too
all
fake.
Starts up and put them in a same mold,
right.
which is unfortunate because you really look back at the 80s, and for those of us who were fortunate enough to be conscious and aware in the 80s, there was a certain flavor, a certain difference in how that period before it became a corporation,
when it was
a startup,
it was new. It
that
really,
was gaining ground, right?
Right?
And we still see it every once in a while here, but it immediately goes into an IPO or immediately goes into something like that.
Or venture
right?
capitalist,
it doesn't have that
right.
that lifestyle, that mystique that builds around it
yeah,
that used to happen
right.
in the 80s.
And so it felt like the same rock and roll when I was in. I worked with David
it's
Lee Roth.
Kind of like rock and roll early days. Rock and roll, or
I worked with a bunch of rock and rollers, David Lee Roth
industry,
and the
yeah.
Police and some other
yeah, yeah.
stuff like that. So, Dave. Steve Vai and some others that were real big at the time. So I took that same vibe and brought it over to this new thing called entrepreneurship, mm-hmm. and where guys like Jobs were being treated like rock stars. And celebrities
and
gurus.
That's pretty cutting edge.
It was pretty cutting edge. And I did a lot of it. So I worked with companies then that did a whole bunch of other entrepreneurial startups, including the billiard industry, which came along in 1987 and suddenly went from being old and funky and forgotten to suddenly the color of money came out.
Billiard
cool
industry.
Cutting,
yeah,
billiard, cutting edge. And I fell into that. And then that led me into the hot tub industry, which had that same kind of fun, playboy kind of feel to it.
So now you're representing pool table or billiard companies, you're representing hot tub companies, mm-hmm. outside barbecue, which again, you know, 80s, it wasn't like every friggin' house had you couldn't roll out a barbecue in every house. It didn't exist in every house.
All of these were entrepreneurial, fast-growing companies that somebody had started before there were lots of big tech companies. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, I was in Silicon Valley, so I didn't catch the tech wave.
Right.
But all these other kind of entrepreneurial things that hadn't existed before. The billiard business boom, the hot tub industry
boom.
Well,
and you were also in Southern California. I think the tech industry was very insulated. Like, it took care of its own in Northern California a little bit.
It wasn't down here. So all these other fast-growing, new, emerging technology. I worked in lots of other crazy things. And all of them had that same flavor. Some entrepreneur had a vision, started something out of nowhere, and suddenly became a hot commodity, and everybody had to have it. And I was part of that wave. I was part of the man behind the curtain that helped create that wave of enthusiasm.
And you said it before, that's when then the market went down under, the construction business probably, or the construction industry went down under, and the economy hit a recession, right?
Well, we had a couple along the way, but the Great Recession was really the killer for all this
So you were involved in doing this until when?
Until 2008, 2007, something like that.
Okay, now I'm going to ask you for a little extra time today.
Okay.
All right, because we're not even close. Right?
But who wants to hear my story?
I think people are fascinated. Can I get a couple of loves for
anything
Paul here?
What I did go through is I was...
Can I get some likes and love for Paul for anybody who's watching on Facebook?
Please,
because
please.
I want him to give us a little bit more time today. I think his story is fascinating. And we're just getting to the point where now he's faced by another dilemma.
Well, you know what it was? Right? For anybody who's younger, I grew up in the... I was born in the 50s, the Leave It to Beaver area, and loved watching that show when I was a little kid.
You're still living it.
Then I grew up in the 60s and the hippie and the crazy stuff that you all dream about and remember. I was the young kid looking at it, the 10, 12-year-old looking at it, with my friends' older brothers and sisters.
Which, by the way, the Leave It to Beaver was not of your generation, right? It was before.
Yeah, but I was the
no, no,
I was
but,
the little
but,
kid.
But,
yeah,
but,
right.
but it was before, right? So there was a nostalgic connection
when
to the
I was
show.
A little kid, Leave It to Beaver was a popular
the reason,
show.
The reason why I mentioned that is because it's really a fascinating thing that happens in the United States. We tend to have shows that not necessarily so much remind us of what's happening today, but try to nostalgically take us back to a time that we have framed as being better.
I grew up in Mayberry.
We, in a way, just had an election that actually feeds into that same exact thing,
Amen.
Right? Okay, sorry, go ahead.
That's a fascinating thing about the United States. I was born in the 50s. I grew up in the 60s. I came of age in the 70s, which was kind of a real disco, and other than disco, wasn't known for much in the 70s.
God, I just saw you in a leisure suit.
Oh, I had one.
I wish I didn't have
Jan,
this.
Come on. Tell me about my leisure suit. And then I came of age in
business age. Can I get a John Travolta stand, please?
Oh. Okay. And then I came of age in the 80s, my business age in the 80s, which was the birth of not only the Reaganism, but it was the yuppies, mm-hmm. and where hippies became yuppies. And suddenly we flipped, and suddenly we're going to be entrepreneurial creators. And the new celebrities were the entrepreneurs. And so I took my experience in the entertainment industry with what you would think of as classic entertainers, celebrities, and applied it to these new entertainers and celebrities.
Okay, so you're selling pool tables, or you're promoting, I should say, doing exposure for pool tables, for jacuzzis, for outside barbecues, and other crazy things, and you're weathering a couple economic ups and turns, ups and downs, and then we get the big recession that hits.
Which wiped out
in this until the big recession.
Yes, which wiped out most of these. You didn't have to get a pool table anymore. You didn't have to get a hot tub.
Lucky if I still have a house.
Yeah, exactly.
To put it in, right.
And so those industries suffered harder. They were not must-have items, and they got hit the hardest. The hot tub industry dropped 70% in 2 years. It's never recovered.
What time period is this, Paul?
2007, 2008, whenever the Great Recession was. I don't remember when it
happened. So you were involved in this until 2007, 2008.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And now I literally, my business was wiped out. So I closed up the shop, literally sat in my house for a year. My wife's screaming at me, and I'm saying, I kept staring at the computer saying, there's something in there. I got to find something new to finish for a next act.
How old are you at this point?
Well, let's see. I'm 61 now, so it's like 10 years, 50, early 50s.
So you're here in your 50s, let's say, early 50s.
At the top of my career, I'm just going to ride this out.
You're going to ride this all the way. You know, you're going to retire. You're going to have all the toys. You're going to have time with your wife, this stuff. And then you get a kick in the stomach.
The whole thing got pulled out from underneath.
And
me.
So I want to, again.
Almost went bankrupt, all the stuff. Almost lost my house, everything bad.
I want to paint this picture. Because, again, what I'm trying to point out is that you, knowing it or not knowing it, had the tools and the DNA programming to weather the storm.
Yes.
Okay? Here you are in your 50s, and for those who basically face similar challenges, whether you're in their 30s, 40s, or 50s.
I was getting fat and happy in my 50s. I wasn't working as hard as I used to.
Yeah, he's already worked hard. He's starting to cash in. He's got clients that are basically paying their bills every month. He's not having to chase them.
Right. Big clients.
All things
well-known.
Are fine. Yeah. He's in Southern California. Friggin' industry's selling houses like it's going out of style.
When you went to the National Billiard Show, I was a big deal. When you went to the National Hot Tub Show, I was a big deal. I knew all the big players. People knew my name. I walked in like I was somebody, you know. And all of a sudden, that industry, both industries, just blew up.
So there's also that's important also to point out is there was also a personal kick in the stomach.
Yeah, I was somebody. I'd worked my way up to. Neither of these industries are where I thought I would end up. But by accident and hard work and timing, I ended up in two industries that boomed and then went bust.
And
sort of like people do with real estate or others. You could fill in the blank. There were a bunch of those.
And here you are, basically. Here you are now. All of a sudden, how many people did you interact with on a weekly basis, roughly, when you were at the height of your career? In that career?
Oh, well, I had people who worked for me. I had an office. I had
Were you constantly? How many people had worked for you?
I never probably got more than about two or three or four or something like
at
that.
At all times?
Yeah.
You had how many clients, just roughly?
Oh, 15 or 20.
15 or 20 clients, a staff of about four or five people, you're calling your own shots.
Yeah.
You're basically walking into conferences and people know your name.
Top business, working, representing the top names in my field, yeah.
Okay, and then all of a sudden you're now at home.
Yeah, with nothing.
The phone's not ringing.
I have nothing.
You're staring at a computer.
Yeah.
You're eating through savings.
Yeah. Out to the point where I almost lost my house, and my marriage suffered. Everybody's mad at me. Paul suddenly has exploded. The world's exploded, and I can't figure out how to get back on the horse.
So you got relationship stress as well.
Oh, everything. Yeah.
Okay.
It was horrible.
Okay.
And at the same time, that's when I decided to adopt a daughter. In my 50s,
no disrespect to your daughter, but this is like one of those stories where we had relationship problems, and we decided we'd get a puppy or
yeah,
have
exactly.
a baby.
Right. Right. Kind of like that.
Okay.
Yeah, kind
All right.
of like that.
Okay. Interesting.
Some of that would help. And because I you know what I remember vividly saying?
We need
saying,
a project to bring us together.
And I vividly remember saying, and people have probably felt this, I remember myself saying, I'm so tired of work. I'm so disillusioned. I've had it. You work, honey. She had always a steady, successful career in banking over 30-some years, 40 or whatever it is. And she was making money in health insurance. Oh, wow. Somebody's shooting off cars and shots in her.
No, you just pushed up against the thing behind you.
Oh, is it? Okay.
Yeah.
So anyway, I remember saying to her and everybody else, I quit. That's it. I'm done. I'm going to do something totally different. I'm going to raise a kid. So at 50 now, I'm going to adopt a 10-year-old girl. And I'm going to devote myself full-time to that.
A male baby boomer wannabe. Baby boomer.
Who put off having kids.
Okay, is faced with basically being his business going under at the age of 50, sitting at home, and figures, I quit working, I'm going to go raise a child.
Yeah.
And you consider yourself the victim of conventionalism. Yeah, okay.
So we adopted a girl from Mexico, found her in foster care, and it was the most exciting, difficult, crazy, unbelievable ride. She could barely speak English. I couldn't speak Spanish. She'd never been to school. She couldn't read or write. She couldn't add two and two. And I spent years working with her and fighting to get her through school. And I was Mr. Mom. I stayed home and pretty much did that.
At the age of 50.
Yeah. And suddenly I'm trying for a couple of years and just kind of sat and thought. And it didn't work economically for us. I quickly realized I had to get back and start working after a couple of years. But for a while, it filled my – gave me a new purpose, new passion, new reason, and a whole new
experience. So what then causes you to pursue what you're – I'm assuming is what you're currently doing at that point in time. At that juncture, what brought this around?
I realized I had to get some more money.
Okay.
That became clear. My wife made it clear. My bank made it clear. My mortgager, everybody made it clear. You can't keep doing this. So only thing I knew to do was PR. PR was a dead business. I'd lost all my clients. The PR business had died because the media had died. So even if I got a client, where am I going to place them? I can't get them a story because all the newspapers
Well, at that point in time, people were just barely holding on. They weren't going to spend money on PR.
And if they did, I didn't know where to go. Right. The whole business had changed.
They're lucky if they're still paying their leases on their businesses.
So I originally got one or two PR clients, one of which became our first show, Rick Franzi, God bless him. I had a couple other little ones I'd hung on to from the spa business and stuff. I was making a little bit of money, but not much, eking out a living. And I quickly, I thought, I got to do something else to differentiate myself, to get new clients, to go back and get back on the horse, go back in the PR business, and accidentally discovered podcasting. And through staring at the internet over and over again, literally night after night, I just sit and stare at it and play with it and run through it.
Which I think was probably a very common experience for a lot of people that were facing that. I mean, insomniacs, you couldn't sleep,
you're
stressed out, all the realities of life, the whole thing is crashing around you, you don't know what you're going to do.
So
who do you go to give you even advice on something like that at that point?
So I'm looking through the internet endlessly, night after night, literally year after year for a long period, and discovered podcasting back. And I thought, well, this is kind of like what I did in college. This is radio. And then I realized that this could be if I couldn't get my client's story told by somebody else, if I couldn't be the middleman and convince the paper to write about them or the radio station to interview them, we could do it ourselves.
So really, a lot of things came to point, right? Your experience from college, the academic path. Your experience from the PR?
It did in this sense that it gave me a great world view. My college education, the one thing it had done, it was a broad, what do they call it? A liberal arts education, what do they want to call it? Like where you know a little bit about a lot of things.
You know, what's interesting about what you say, Paul, is I think a lot of people, especially these days, part of it is because of the financial realities and pressures of pursuing an academic path or going after a degree. In a lot of cultures, the word for college almost parallels the word for a place of collection, a place of gathering, right? In this case, the idea is it's a place of collection of collecting knowledge, collecting experiences. You know, we jokingly say, oh, yeah, it's a college experience. Yeah, but it's interesting because I think your own personal experience that you shared says is that by going there and exploring, we talk about the show being a journey of exploration, right? That we are constantly exploring. If you have that, and that's what you're lucky enough to experience during college, there are things that come along the way that you may not even realize until later in life or when you're challenged in certain ways that you picked up along the path. If you have blinders on and you're so focused on an agenda and a to-do list, sometimes, you know, it's a cliche. Oh, you know, stop and smell the roses. It's not about stopping and smelling the roses. Stop and explore what's on the side of the street because who knows?
People are always amazed.
And here's a perfect example where all of this stuff that you didn't get a degree in radio.
No.
Right? You didn't really even get a degree in PR.
Mm-mm.
Right, you didn't get a degree in sales of copiers either.
No.
Right, and yet sales, PR, radio are very integrated into what you do today.
And I will tell you that people are always amazed on this show the breadth of knowledge I have on a wide range of subjects. I'm not trying to toot my horn. I'm just saying that I have the benefit of a true liberal arts education.
Yeah.
I learned a lot. I learned a little bit about a lot of things. So I know a little bit about a lot of things. We do 20 different shows, and I time after time, I'm amazed myself, or people are amazed that I know something about them. And I say, well, because I had this breadth of wide-ranging education.
I'm not trying to defend liberal arts education. I happen to have one. But I will tell you, sometimes it gets maligned, right, as not being focused enough. Right. And I will say, if you really wanted to be practical and pragmatic, you would probably admit that life will get you focused. Those years when you're in college, yes, especially when you're spending a lot of money, need to have some sort of leverageable, some sort of traction of what you do later, not be like Paul necessarily, where you don't have a plan of what you're going to do later.
Right.
Right. I think that's a common mistake I was guilty of. And I think I advise people to have a plan. But to look at the situation and say that unless every minute I am in college, I am doing something that's developing a skill that I can then monetize.
Right.
Is sort of a shame, and it's a sad reality of where we have become as a society, because being a person who had liberal arts education, another person who had liberal arts education, there was so much that we gathered and collected that enrich our lives today.
And I didn't realize
that realize it at the time.
Yes, exactly.
Right.
And how it's helped me today, how it's all, in a weird way, just what you said, I finally feel that at age 60, I have found something that's brought all of these different passions together. The celebrity and fame and attention, mm-hmm. performing and radio and the media and communicating, where I get to go listen in on dozens of different, wildly different conversations, sort of like going from one class to another here, mm-hmm. back in college, mm-hmm. With something that's new and creative and cutting edge and all this stuff. It all seems to fit together, and somehow all of my life experience, for once, seems like it makes sense in what I do now.
So you said, and how long have you been doing this?
5 years.
5 years.
Mm-hmm.
Have you seen a growth in it?
Yes. Oh, absolutely.
Professionally as well as personally?
Yes.
Okay. Do you have other benefits of doing it that you would say are rewarding to you other than maybe the financial stability?
Oh, incredible. I get tickets to all sorts of events. Now I have a grandson, and we get to go to the Disney on Ice and the pet expos and baseball games and stuff, because we get exposure to that and get tickets and do giveaways and other sorts of things. And we get invited to events and get to see cool things. And I feel, again, like I'm on the cutting edge of stuff. I'm on the leading edge. I get to meet the most. What I loved about PR was I got to meet. I wasn't doing it, which was a little frrustrating, but I got to be the guy next to. I was Forrest Gump. You know, I was the guy next to the guy doing it.
Right.
And I got to meet the most amazing, incredible people doing the most incredible things.
And you know what? There's a certain reason why I wanted you to put you in the hot seat.
I can't imagine why.
Well, because there's a part of you that was still doing that.
Yeah.
You do that here. You are not the guy that's hosting the show,
no,
but you're the
right.
guy sort of on the side. And in a lot of shows, if you listen to a lot of shows on OC Talk Radio, my assumption is based on what Paul has said, is that he gets to weigh in sometimes, but he's more or less basically just behind the scenes again,
right.
kind of doing that role. From day one, when we started this, I really felt that his voice added to the Rad Life was something that was very...
genuine, maybe, because of my age or something? Or different?
You know what? I think we just got a solicitation to be a sponsor for something.
Ooh,
hey,
okay.
Craig, I know you're listening. What was that about the CLIC, which is the California Lodging Industry Conference? You want what? Who to be a sponsor? I can't see your note, Craig. So just
we'll go cover it. I don't hear what.
Yeah, he just gave me a thumbs up. So. Go ahead and type it in again, or even better still, Craig, do me a favor. If you got a minute, call this number and talk to us.
949-330-7761.
7761.
So 15 minutes.
Craig Sullivan, we got about 15 minutes still on the air. I want you to call and tell us about this, and let's get a little exposure for CLIC.
Yeah, we'll give you a little.
Craig Sullivan put on a conference for the California Lodging Industry Conference at the Hilton down here, right? It was the first year that they did it this year.
I wish he had told us. We would have had him come in.
Well,
we would have interviewed him. We would have given him some exposure. We're always trying to find those kind of events that are going on.
Well, I am involved with him for next year, but I want to see what he has to say, and he's a local guy, so you know, call in and say, and that goes to everybody else who's watching. If you want to call in and say hi to Paul, share with you what your thoughts on the show or whatever, let's give that number out again. Paul, 949
330
330-7760.
776. I'm sorry, 7761.
7761. 330-7761, 949 area code. Give us a call. Let's get a couple of calls in here before the end. But, Paul, you know, the cool thing about this for me is I don't see what you're doing today, and I don't know if you agree with me or not, as something that really has a time limit on it, right? You could pretty much do this. And the technology is getting even smaller and smaller.
Yeah, I could be doing this in my 70s.
So we joke about the fact that, you know, when we start talking, we're talking about doing it here, and we're just doing it to radio, and it was going out across the internet. Within a six-month period, we're now showing it on YouTube.
And then Facebook
releases this thing called live feeds, and you're watching it right now on live feed, right, on Facebook. And it's all recorded. And, you know, we don't edit really a lot, right? But here's content development that's happening, and it's sharing somebody's story that is, you know, to the benefit of everybody maybe who's going through college right now, people who are concerned about what they do at the age of 50 when they find themselves in that reality. And it's amazing. So there's no real limit to how long you can do this.
No, I lived all those things you talked about. I lived the crazy days of the 60s. I lived the lost times of the 70s. I lived the 80s when we became yuppies. And entrepreneurs became part of our lexicon and our world of celebrities. And cutting-edge technologies changed the whole world into the 90s. And then it all crashed. And I'm in my 50s, and I had to reimagine myself. And now I'm in my 60s wondering, how am I going to, what is in this next chapter and how long does it
last? So there's a part of you that's scared.
Very much so.
But there's a part of you that's got to take a lot of strength and sort of assurance from what you're doing. I mean, this is pretty cool stuff to be doing at the age of 60.
You know what's cool about this, too?
We refer to it jokingly as an encore career. Here's the man living an encore career.
You can't see the sign because I'd have to move the studio around here, but there's a sign that I've always wanted my whole life to finally put up here. It says, "My Way or the Highway."
I think people that are watching it on Facebook can see it. It's right in the corner there.
Now, why is that fun to me? Because for my whole life, my success was based on someone else's success. I worked for you. I represented you. I helped you.
Yep.
And to a certain degree, I still do that. I help Rod. I help all the other shows. I help develop them. I try and encourage them. I try and guide them. I try and coach them. I give them a platform. I try and help them move into this new world and become who they are. And yet at the same time, for the first time, this is my business. I don't have investors. I don't report to anybody. I mean, I had my own PR business, but this is different. It's something tangible.
You can grow it to whatever level you want.
Right.
Or you can be comfortable with whatever level it's at.
Right.
You can decide when those shifts happen.
I could sell it to somebody.
You can't sell
your own personal business. You can't sell your design business to somebody because it's based on your skills. Even though you have clients, the clients don't want to work necessarily
The trick with that one is you just change the name to basically letters.
Yeah, right.
But that's always
been the challenge with service professionals. Once people are buying your relationship with you, they're buying your skills. If you leave, what keeps them around?
I'm going to share something with you that Craig Sullivan just said on Facebook, and I think if I may take it a little further, Craig, is encore is the best part. If you think about being in a concert and you just watch a great concert,
that's interesting,
and then you basically won't leave because you won that one last bit, that encore, right? And in many cases, that's what people will remember: is my God, he came back on the stage. He came back on the stage of life.
That's right.
And he had an encore that was phenomenal.
That is phenomenal. I never
thought
of
that. Thank you,
Greg.
That's awesome. Encore career is not just what you do because, you kind of exhausted the first time. An encore is actually the best part. I think we need to coin that, Greg.
I like that.
Encore is the best part. Okay, so go sell that to a hotel chain that basically will do something nostalgic.
Because it really
called Encore.
True. I'm having more fun and more satisfaction and, oddly enough, making more money than I've made in a long, long, long time.
On your terms.
On my terms.
On your way.
My way.
Okay. I do want to give a shout-out to Craig, too. Aloha, my friend. I appreciate your input, man, and thanks for watching. Craig is the founder of the California Lodging Industry conference, which is the only California-based lodging industry conference. And it took place in Orange County this year, and next year it's also taking place in Orange County. And And I was honored to have Greg. Actually, we'll have him over because we want to talk about that. Yeah, and especially because we do talk about boomers and how the industry that's
one of our other shows or develop a show about the lodging industry.
We probably have a lot of crossover between developers and people.
He should
especially
be doing
in Orange
a
County.
Show about what's happening in that industry.
Yeah, you know, Greg, we can get Larry on here. We can get some of the people on here that are pretty instrumental gatekeepers. I think we can have a really great show.
Because here's what's different about this medium, and I preach this all the time.
He preaches a lot of stuff all the time.
I do. I feel like I feel like I'm a born. You know, there's nothing worse than a born again.
Done.
A born again.
He's
anything.
A born again radio person.
A born again radio person. A born again entrepreneur. A born again businessman. A born again.
In a way, that's out. Encore, right?
Yeah, exactly. After giving up so many times, I've been born again and found new passion, new purpose, and new religion. And here's my new religion. All of this new media is not broadcasting. Yes, it goes to the whole world. It's narrowcasting. It really is designed for a subsector of the world. It's a niche. And why is that good? Because it's no longer important how many people listen. It's who listens.
Right. Right. No, absolutely. And, you know, people always say, well, you know, how do you know? Do you know how many people basically listen to your show? And I'm like, well, not really. But, you know, we've been doing this for 2 years. I've been kind of carrying the cost on my own, thanks to Paul and some terms he has for me. And by the way, we are looking for sponsors. So if you've enjoyed this show and you're considering it, you know,
content for you,
we'd love to do that. You know, we used to joke, a buddy of mine, I'm going to give us another shout out, kind of product placement here, but Bespoke Style is the website. And then Spoke, S-P-O-K-E, Style.
Which means custom if you're in England.
Custom if you're in England or Europe. Dave Welsh, he became a sponsor of the show early on because he's a friend of mine, and I'm a brand ambassador for him. But the joke was that we would say that a custom tailor, a bespoke tailor, basically dresses me for radio.
Yeah, right.
Now, we used to say that before we started broadcasting on YouTube
television,
and
yeah,
Facebook.
Right.
So that... If you're interested, we do get. I would say we have a loyal following, and a lot of the people that I know personally. Thank you so much for being supportive of this show, and a lot of you guys have been very kind with your words over the last 2 years.
And even more powerfully, look at the guests you've gotten.
Yeah,
this isn't usually just us bantering and fooling around. It's really powerful content where you're having conversations with people that you would never meet, I would never meet, and your audience would never meet.
We've had a range, and I actually really feel very fortunate and blessed to have had that range. I never knew what the show... This is kind of like Paul. I didn't really know what this show was going to be. He provided an opening. I took it. I was 50. I was like, oh, why the heck not, right?
Back again.
50. There's that milestone, right? And at the same time, it has led to so many opportunities with meeting people. You know, we start off with Casey Kasem's daughter, Carrie, who's a friend. If you're watching or you ever watch this again, Carrie, thank you so much for being a friend. For all that you do, it's amazing what the Kasem Care Foundation does. You know, go find out about it. We had Frank Shankwitz, who is the founder of the Make a Wish Foundation. He called in from Arizona. Frank is a friend. I mean, all these people that were so
Geronimo's great
grandson yesterday. Greg Rath from Mission Viejo.
Mayor of Mission Viejo.
Josh Newman, who is now a California senator, and on and on. Jose Moreno, who is the first Latino to basically hold office of the city council in Anaheim for District 3, which is newly formed. I mean, all this stuff that is part of the experience, part of our common experience
in
Southern California.
Part of the rad life.
And part of the rad life. And Paul, in a way... has once again, and I said it when I first started the show, I thanked him as a baby boomer for clearing the path, for laying the groundwork, for making my generation as a next generation, for us making it easier for us to follow in that, to not have to be conventional, to explore, right? And here's another perfect example where there's a mirroring and some mirroring and echoing of his experience and what he went through in his own individualized way and what happened with me just by doing the show. Mm-hmm. I do want to close the loop on Craig Sullivan's thing, and I want to say that thank you. I want to thank Craig for basically giving me the opportunity also to be part of his experience. That's another thing that's his, you know, innovation.
Well, because these circles start intersecting, you know.
Right.
And
well, but he's given me the opportunity to actually design the stage for the 2018 California Lodging Industry Conference that will also, again, take place in Costa Mesa.
I would love to have him. Why don't you bring him in? We talk about developing a show specifically for that industry. Would it be a niche?
Already talked to him about it, about possibly doing that as a co-hosting situation with him and I. And
because that's what we're trying to find is conversations nobody else has. We don't do comedy. We don't do music. We don't
do
a lot of the – well, okay. But we don't do a lot of the – you know what I mean. We don't do a lot of the – I'm not trying to get – this isn't a YouTube channel. We're trying to get a million people watch me play with my cat or play with something. We're going to play with something. I don't even want to go there.
Look at the time. I think it's time. For
But it's about five. It's who listens, not how many.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. And I think
building a community.
It's also something that I'm really happy to say. Correct me if I'm wrong, almost everybody, if not everybody, who has ever been a guest on the show, on The Rad Life, has come out, and the first thing that they say as they are putting off, taking off their ears and walking away from the chair is, that was fun.
Yes.
Even though we've talked about end of life, we've talked about hospice, we've talked about elder abuse, we've talked about
serious topics.
But we've also talked about pursuit of passion, a perfect example. We had a couple of fine artists, each coming to it from a different perspective.
And the life changes that we're
life changes in. And being open to the journey, but also having the confidence and the courage to explore. And not to stop doing that. And I think, again, you know, going back to Not appreciating or underplaying the critical sense of urgency and worry that a baby boomer at this point in their life in their 60s and 70s are having, that maybe are feelings that you don't really know how to deal with.
Never been scared before.
Scared in this way about this thing
that
is an unknown. But at the same time, just by our conversation today, how many reminders did you personally feel?
Amazing.
Going through just a recap, a reflection on your journey.
Because I think
that you weathered those storms.
Because Simon Sinek is his favorite thing, you know, find your why. It's all over TED Talks and YouTube. Go Google it, S-I-N-E-K, Simon Sinek, find your why. And my why is I've always loved talking. God knows. And as anybody who's listened to the show knows, I talk way too much. Mm-hmm. But I do because I love to learn, not just to talk and tell my story, but to listen, hear other people's stories. That's why I was listening to history. History is listening to other people's stories.
Right.
And every week I get privileged to sit in here and listen to the most amazing people come in and tell the most amazing stories. And I'm just fascinated by it. And we don't, in some modern society, get a chance or set the time aside to talk very often.
And we've said this a lot of times. Yeah.
Everything's quick, fast, condensed.
Well, or there's some sort of to-do list or there's some sort of agenda. I mean, you just look at yourselves and your lives, and unless you were born maybe in the last 5 years or 10 years, I would put money on the table that you can remember one incident, if not just multiple incidents, where you earlier on, before you got into the work mode and having to run from one task to another, or you know all the stuff, that you actually had somebody, could be a friend, could be a family member, maybe an uncle, not necessarily a parent, could be a parent, somebody that you basically just had banter, that you did, wasn't one-upmanship, it was just discussion. It could be activated by
you found
you
it
know,
fascinating to just current talk of, or current shoot of, the breeze
current yeah, events right. or maybe nothing
sports or something
sports, right. The conversations weren't even linear. You know, they kind of went all over the map.
There was no time limit.
And you look back at those moments and you go, you got something out of that.
Yes.
You don't necessarily know it at the time, but you got something out of it. Your life was enriched by it. You got a wider perspective. You were able to maybe look at
things
in a bigger
picture.
But we
used to do that at dinner. When I was a kid, we did that at dinner.
Dinner table conversation's gone.
That's gone. We used to do that where we would gather with friends and go out camping. Or I always say this is like an online campfire.
Well, and nobody's on their devices.
Right.
Right? And nobody is basically there just to basically say, hey, hi, how are you? I got to go.
Right.
I'm just looking
at something else.
Hang on. In a way, the 70s show Basement.
Yeah, right. Exactly. We used to, when I was a kid, we hung out with each other in the basement.
We hung out.
Yeah, we hung
People
out.
Don't hang out anymore.
No.
Right. And that is a sad commentary. I think we've lost something as a society doing that.
We don't talk. We don't converse. We don't just share ideas and information. We don't allow for that free time, free exchange.
Well, when do we work things out? When do we talk
to each other? Right now, we've divided into a highly partisan group, and I've got friends back in the Midwest that think I'm nuts, and I think they're nuts. We don't have the opportunity to sit down and talk it out anymore.
So I think as a nation, the art of talking to one another versus at one another is something that we have lost. And I will tell you, for everybody, including some family members, have said to me, how do you monetize this show? How do you benefit your business from the show? The answer is, I don't. But I enrich my life because what I get out of this is in the middle of my week on Wednesdays, 12 to 1, every week, I get a chance to sit down and basically have a conversation with somebody that isn't based on an agenda. Yes, we have, you know, what do they do?
And what am I going to get out of it?
But that's only part of their story. And we have been – I purposely do not prepare for these shows extensively because I do not want to rob myself and the people around the table and Paul – of the experience of just exploring.
Spontaneously.
And spontaneously with somebody.
In the moment, reacting. And all the stuff that we valued when I was in the 60s, the spontaneous, in the moment, free exchange, open exchange, talking to people of different points of view, trying to sit down and get to understand them and think and yes, convince them what you do.
Not because I'm trying to get a deal on them, not because I'm trying to one-up them, but just for the purpose of doing it. And you know what? Get rid of the friggin' to-do list. Throw away the friggin' agenda. Every friggin' meeting I go to has a friggin' agenda. Why? We're going to forget who the hell the people around the table are and what we're there to do?
Everything is not about making a deal.
Not everything is about making the deal. Sorry, Mr. President, but it's not about the art of the deal every friggin' time.
Right. So just like there was value in a liberal education, just like there was value in hanging out and value in the communal dinners and value in the old campfire idea where you gathered and swapped stories, some of that we need to do as human beings. And out of that, yes, opportunities do arise. There are things that come your way, knowledge you get, connections you make, opportunities that present themselves. But you go. That was the purpose, on a bigger plane, that was the purpose of social media, supposedly, that there was no payoff to doing Twitter and Facebook and LinkedIn other than that you got to communicate.
But social media has been co-opted by advertising and targeting now.
Exactly.
You know, and we said we would talk about it. You know, the recent thing about no net neutrality and pretty much anybody being able to track everything that you do, that's sad.
Right.
I mean, that's really sad. You know, I have a Facebook page, for example, and I do everything in my power to, some people will say, run it as a dictatorship, but I do everything in my power to maintain that place as a safe place for people to come in and actually be able to voice something, and anybody who steps out of line is gone.
And just real quickly, so if anybody, go Google the term net neutrality, you'll be shocked. The Trump administration is threatening to revisit that issue, which the Obama administration, I think, correctly ruled against for. Net neutrality is this. Is the Internet a utility that the government created and runs on our behalf? Yes, clearly. And therefore, should cable companies or the wireless companies that deliver the service to you, the Internet to you, should they be allowed to restrict which companies are on the Internet? Should they be able to say, you know what, we're not going to bring OC Talk Radio into you because they didn't pay us to be on the Internet. They didn't pay us enough. Or if they do allow us to, if they do deliver our programming through that pipeline into your, so you pay to get the pipeline in, they also want to charge people the other side to pay to get in the pipeline.
I got a newsflash. For everybody who goes down this path and spends so much friggin' time trying to control, there's two things to live by. The first thing is, there are those who innovate, and there are those who copy or try to control.
Right.
Those who try to copy and control and try to benefit and profit from that will never, okay, mark my words, will never stifle the spirit of those who innovate. Everything that's happening today with undermining internet neutrality.
Right.
Okay. I will put money on the table that some friggin' server on some remote island with a very high broadcasting broadband will gather members that will not pay a penny, and they will look for that freedom of speech, and they will basically ban it. And if you don't believe me, then you think about cable. You think about a couple of years ago
cable
when everybody
controlled
basically
environment,
controlled
yeah.
environment of cable, and everybody right. who canceled their Cox or whatever cable company membership and bought a friggin' antenna where they could pick up public air stuff and then also stuff. And God knows what other versions it will be available.
Or over the internet.
The
cord cutters, they're calling them. And that's exactly what they want to do. Again, the same companies that deliver the internet.
It might go to sleep
house.
For about 5 years, but I guarantee you there will be a disruptor. There yes, will be right. something that basically changes the narrative. And then we'll spend another 10 years trying to control that narrative. Right. And then after that, we'll go through the cycle all over again.
Well, everybody who look values at the openness and neutrality of the internet needs to send a letter to their congressman or a tweet or a note, go on their Facebook page and say, do not change net neutrality. Because here's what it does. It means that it's a utility and it's neutral. I have the same access to it as
a large multi-million-dollar corporation.
Right. Yeah. If and at the same speed, because what the carriers want to do is two things. They want to restrict, like cable. They want to say you pay to get it, and then you pay to get on it. So they get paid from both ends. And if you don't pay to get on it, you can be on the internet, but not our internet. We're not going to bring it into our homes. Or if we do, we're going to put you on a slower speed. We're going to put you on a bumpy back road.
But Paul, you know what? Let's make this prediction because right. we've said this here before. All news is local news.
Yeah.
All news is absolutely. Local news. Okay.
All politics.
You don't
is local.
Want me to you don't want me to be on your portal or on your channel. Guess what? I'll find another channel, and anybody who is like me has 5,000 people on Facebook and cannot be adding anymore. If you're a gatekeeper and an influencer of a group of people of 5,000 that then have another 5,000, that have another 5,000,
right.
and have another 5,000, that nature of the internet will survive any friggin' control that is needed because we don't need...
But it's under assault.
It is under assault right
so
now.
They would
and
say,
you should do what Paul is saying, which is basically send a letter or a tweet or a message to your congressman. You know, and the thing
don't let them change... Because net neutrality says that anybody has everybody has access to put your own website on the internet and they have to deliver it to the house. They can't pick and choose who paid for it and who didn't.
Right.
If you have an internet site... You have the equal access to the internet as everybody else has. In other words,
regardless of your socioeconomic level, anything.
Political views, anything. And you don't have to pay to be on the internet. I don't have to pay to put my business on the internet. I'm on the internet, which is a public utility, and therefore those who disseminate that into your house, that bring it into your house, have to carry my programming just like they have to carry over. And if they do carry it, they can't put it at a worse rate. They can't put it at a slower speed. So the idea is Netflix is saying, we'll pay more to have our stuff get streamed faster, which means that the rest of the pipeline gets downgraded, gets smaller.
Yeah.
And therefore, all the other smaller sites like your Facebook pay or your all these pages you have, those would now operate at a slower speed. You couldn't put video. You couldn't put audio on them. You couldn't have as much bandwidth. And it would choke off all the smaller sites.
And that's only in terms of access. Then you have the added complication of what happens to your online privacy.
Well, that's the other thing that assaulted.
And what happens to your online privacy in terms of the record of what you go to, who you talk to.
Under the Obama administration, they said that was private. That if you went and searched for Viagra, they couldn't sell that to a Viagra company who would then start calling you or pestering you with ads. Or even worse, sell it to an employer who says, oh, he's looking at Viagra. Oh, he looked at porn. Oh, he looked at something questionable.
He's a sexual deviant.
Yeah, I don't know if I want to hire this guy.
Yeah.
Unseen in all this chaos going on in Washington, Trump administration already dropped that regulation. So now all the search engines who are monitoring everything you search, and as your phone goes over the internet, every phone call you make.
Mm-hmm.
So if you call a suicide hotline, that may haunt you the rest of your life. That may be they'll sell that information to an employer.
Wait, and we can now discriminate against pre-existing conditions. So if you call the suicide hotline, maybe you are basically manic and have emotional and mental issues. So maybe I can deny you insurance now.
Yeah, all sorts of things.
Right.
So everything you do and say, they already track.
Yep.
Right.
Yep.
We know that.
Yep.
Right now, they only use it to put ads in front of you. So if you search for Viagra. on the internet, suddenly you'll see Viagra ads on your internet browser.
You know what's,
but now they want to take that information and sell it.
I don't know why he's pushing Viagra, but you know.
Or whatever. I'm just trying to use that as an example. Okay. So let's say that you do something, you search for something privately. They will now sell that to others who will know that that's what you search for. So they'll send you ads, they'll call you up and everything, and they'll sell it to employers who, when they do a background check, will say, tell me everything that Rad searched for in the last year. Tell me every phone call he made and what kind of businesses he did. I can then use that to determine whether I want to hire
him. So you know what's
that's frightening.
You know what's really the...
That's already happened.
The amazing thing is that this is being approved in an administration that is by a party that has screamed about privacy.
Yes, and for the little guy. Protect the little guy.
Right.
And
just sold out the little guy.
And their whole argument
for the benefit
is,
of dollars for somebody.
And you say, why would they do this? Because their theory is, the typical Republican line is, anything that's good for big business is eventually good for us. Anything that deregulates them will make them more money. Yeah, it will. They'll make more money by selling this information. They'll make more money by charging internet companies like mine to be on the internet and to be carried into your house,
right,
or to be carried at the same speed as the other guys. I'll have to pay now to be in that pipeline. It won't be a free pipeline for me. All the little sites will have to pay or go away, or... And all the privacy you think you're doing when you're privately searching, all this stuff, which is already being collected, will now be sold to third-party vendors who will sell it to HR companies and to consumer companies who will then market you off of that.
Well, I mean, if you don't believe me, then listen to some of the conversations that were had with like CEOs of Pinterest and Snapchat, and look at what it is that they are basically leveraging their IPO value based on, and it is really about the collection of information
data
and leveraging that information to sell to companies that will then turn around and sell you. Because as everybody knows, retail is failing.
Or use
okay?
it to judge
and so
you.
The only way to... Or judge... Well, it's a fine line. It's,
right.
it's a razor's edge between I'm going to sell you something or I'm going to sell somebody else on what you do.
Right. Exactly.
Right? And where does that stop? And I mean, it's very timely. I think there's a Tom Hanks movie coming out about exactly that. That information gathering that is basically
carried
under the guise of safety and security, and then basically now it's intrusive and
so what
brother.
It would do is if it's carried to its final conclusion, it'll kill the internet because you won't feel everything you search will be stored and sold to other people. Everything, every call you make will be deciphered. It isn't just the NSA listening for terrorist threats.
Right.
They'll be listening for what you did and then selling that to somebody saying, well, he talked about this on his phone call.
Don't you find it fascinating that those are basically having a problem with accidental collection accidental collection when it comes to conversations with possibly Russia are the same ones that just said it's okay to basically have no privacy on the internet?
Exactly.
Fascinating.
And because they know that the big companies will make tons of money selling that data and on the one hand, and they'll also restrict the number of sites that exist on the internet because you'll have to pay to put your – you can be on the internet, but you won't get carried by Cox Cable into people's house unless you pay for it.
Okay. So we've almost spent 2 hours on the air.
Wow.
I appreciate the time, Paul. But let me say this. Two things.
Yes.
Okay. Where does Paul Roberts go from here?
Well, I have another show at 2:00.
Perfectly orchestrated. But no, I mean, where do you go from here? Do you see an end game for you?
What is both frightening and exciting right now is I don't. The sky's the limit. This could be just a one-off little studio, little venture that I ride for a certain period of time until I can't do it anymore or don't want to do it anymore. That may happen.
That's one possibility.
The other is it grows and becomes a model of what radio will become in the 21st century, which is hyper-local little stations over the internet. No longer broadcasting to as big an audience as they can find over as big a footprint as they can push the signal.
Yeah.
I like to believe in that one. Or it could evolve into other things where we create specific content, audio and video content, for other businesses to use to tell their story in a less salesmanlike approach. Here's what,
and storytelling is a big, huge thing, that an authentic storytelling, yeah, I should say, right, is huge. I mean, the thing, the word of the decade right now is authentic and genuinely authentic, because there's a, there people's,
you can smell
piece,
fake,
piece,
yeah,
piece, people's bullshit monitor is at such a heightened state of sophistication now.
That's why this whole argument against fake news is kind of fake in itself, because yeah, what they're trying to do is discredit anybody that doesn't agree with me. Either side.
It's, right. Well, I think news. It was even said, right? If it's coming from the mainstream media, it's got to be fake news. It doesn't right. matter what the topic is.
Right.
It's like that's the broad stroke right. statement.
Until they agree with us, and then they're...
Then it's then not it's, fake news.
Yeah, right.
Okay, so...
The
so,
polls are correct when Donald Trump is up. The polls are okay. fake when he's down.
All right, so obviously not a secret where polls political leanings are, but... So that was the first question, because yeah. I think, and I think you answered it perfectly, is both scary mm-hmm. and exciting.
Mm-hmm.
When was the last time you felt this scary and exciting at the same time?
Back in my 30s, probably.
Interesting. And what were you doing in your 30s? I was stumbling
into this new world, the entertainment industry, and then from there stumbling into this new world of entrepreneurialism.
Interesting, right? So it's kind of an interesting yeah. parallel if you think about it, right?
The world will not look the same in 20 years. I don't know what it'll look like, but it won't look the same. And that's both exciting and scary.
You look forward to finding out?
Oh, I do. I feel like I'm at the front of it.
But that's not necessarily, you know, an immediate response. Some people may say, no, it kind of scares the living daylights out of me. My world is changing so much that I don't know if I can embrace the changes. You know, a lot of people that don't want to go back.
Most of
like
my friends
said,
back in the Midwest want things to go back the way
to the
they
50s.
Were. Right.
Right. That's a safer, nostalgically, we remember it as being a safer time. So that's why I asked that question.
Right.
So again, I will leave you with this. That sense of wonderment, that mm-hmm. sense of excitement mm-hmm. that is, yes, understandably, and in most cases,
and a little bit of
comes
fear
along,
comes into
but
it.
But that's normal.
Yeah.
That always comes. I mean, you look back at your 30s. It wasn't 62, but you were 30, and you still had that same mix of fear mm-hmm. and excitement, right?
Mm-hmm.
So maybe the fear that you're feeling now...
Fear keeps you honest and keeps you grounded. Excitement keeps you going.
From the mouth of Mr. Paul Roberts.
If you walk on stage and you're not a little frightened, then you're doing something wrong. If you start a business and you're not a little frightened, then you're going
to
fail.
Well, you're likely to really step on your you-know-what, right?
Yes, exactly.
At that point. Right. Okay. So that was number one. Now, we had a request, and I would be remiss if I don't have you do this.
What, do you want me to sing?
No. Yes, actually. Actually, yes. Actually, the request came from Scott Duncan, who's president of Spa Gregory's. We've had on the show, too. We had a show about wellness, which we should probably do another one come June in time for Global Wellness Day. We should probably do
something. I'll tell you what I'll do. If you ever want to hear
said,
it,
he said
I'll find my old singing demo somewhere.
No. There's no demo here. There's no pre-recorded.
Oh, I can't sing.
No, he said any – your. A couple of courses or a course from your favorite song, whatever you pick. He left it wide open to you. He said, now, that would be really great. Now, we can't disappoint Scotty.
What was maybe my song? See, you know, I had a 50s group. We used to sing 50s songs, but I don't remember any of those.
Your pick. As we close out the show.
I'm trying to think of something more appropriate than that, though.
Comes to your mind right now? Come on, you're in it. You're a whole bunch of emotions, I'm guessing, are going through you right
yeah.
now. You're reflecting back.
Well, anybody who was a friend of mine back in those days knew I had a 50s band called the Crescendos, and we were pretty hot in a little local suburban area. We played gyms and high schools.
Was this around the same time that you went to Hash Bashes?
Yeah, a couple of years.
We'll talk about Hash Bashes again later. Okay, but go ahead. Yeah, some other show.
So we used to sing a lot of 50 songs, but our big song was Tell Laura I Love Her.
Go ahead.
Laura and Tommy were lovers. He wanted to give her everything, flowers, presents, but most of all, a wedding ring. There you go.
Mr. Paul Roberts, ladies and gentlemen. He sings, he dances. I don't know about dancing. The studio's too small.
Bit,
but
yeah.
He sings, he dances, he entertains.
He
rediscovers what life's journey is all about. And like Craig Sullivan said, encore is the best part.
I really like that. That's my takeaway from today. I never thought about this. Sometimes encore seems like just something like what came before was better, but this is, I'm just trying to keep it going. But really, when you think about it, when you listen to a band perform, the encore is often the most memorable
part
of the evening.
Isn't it also after an evening, like you're not cold, you're warmed up, you've gone through your chops, you've played,
done your best,
you're comfortable in this environment, you put it all out there, and it's just that one more.
Yeah.
At the top of the game.
I'll tell you another interesting thing is I'm like my aunt and my mother before me, I'm fascinated with desserts. I'm just a freak about desserts. And that's not popular anymore because they're fattening and bad and everything else. And when I had bars and restaurants, I was always trying to put effort into desserts. Nobody likes dessert. Nobody buys desserts. Desserts are a lost art. And yet, isn't dessert the encore? You've had a great meal, and then something more comes that's even more amazing, that's even more tasty, sweet.
So at 62 years old,
right?
I think we can leave Mr. Paul Roberts. 61 years
don't
old.
Push me too fast.
We can leave Mr. Paul Roberts here with the epiphany that you are in the dessert part
that.
Of life.
Ooh, boy.
That encore is the best part?
This is the dessert. I'm going to use that one. That's a fascinating analogy of what this time period is that nobody ever thought about.
And guess what, Paul? Nobody is scared of dessert.
And as you get older, like my aunt is 92, and she loves desserts. She'll eat anything now. She said, I don't worry anymore. I'm 92.
So you know what, Paul? 61 years old. Life is a dessert.
Life is a dessert.
You shouldn't worry anymore.
I had my salad days. Wasn't that a term for sort of your younger, happier, carefree time?
You know, you keep this going, we're going to have to call Ryan Wagner from the Connerly Lab and start talking food. And it's lunchtime.
Yeah.
It's 2 o'clock, and I didn't get lunch.
Think about that, though. The salad days are that's an old-fashioned description for your younger.
Salad days are your younger days.
And then
the main course is when you're, in your
most productive period.
Most productive period, and when you get you're older.
Now I'm in the coffee period.
It's not the waiting at the bus station for God's big bus to show up. It's the dessert part of life.
The part that I used to go without, and now I'm doing, because I used to say why.
I like that. I like that, because you put everything else, that part of you on hold to pursue other things that you were supposed to do, and now
you
are.
I never ate dessert when I was younger because it was bad for you, and I didn't have the time, or I was trying to save money,
this guy, the funny thing about him is that the minute he, life is a dessert, order twice, thank you. That's, I can't see who that is, but somebody just wrote, life is a dessert, order twice. Thank you so much for that. I appreciate people being. We just got a notification from Facebook that this is the most watched, unliked show that we've
really?
Ever had on Facebook. Yeah,
how about that?
So thanks everybody for joining us
Yay.
Today. I think it's a little out of the ordinary. Turn on Paul. Say hi here. Thank you guys.
We gotta go.
It was awesome. We gotta go. Join us next Wednesday, 12 to 1.
Who knows what we'll do.
On the Rad Life.
Who knows what little desserts will bring you.
What little desserts will bring you.
What treats.
Well, maybe we don't want to move the time, though, right, after lunch.
I know. It's kind of appropriate. We're doing it around lunchtime. I never thought of that.
So join us next Wednesday for a sumptuous feast.
A treat.
Of life.
A tasty.
As we journey on the Rad Life.
A tasty little morsel that you would otherwise ignore.
This is why I can't shut him up. You got an Irishman in the room that just basically had an epiphany about his life.
Yeah.
And he'll probably be talking my ear off if I allowed him to hear.
So
we're gonna call it a day. And you guys can all reach me either on Facebook or but you can call me at 949-212-8299. That's my cell phone. Make sure that you use that, gingerly, don't kill it. And then you can always email me at Rod, R-A-A-D, period, Gantos, G-H-A-N-T-O-U-S, @gmail.com. If you have any ideas for the show, let me know what you thought. Thank you so much for all of you guys, for all the support for the last 2 years and for being here. I thought it was important that we turned the camera the other way and we showed the behind the scenes. And, Paul, I want to just, on the air again, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Very much. And keep opening those doors for us, young ones. You know, you're not doing that yet. You're not done doing that yet.
All right.
So thank you, my friend.